But they've shown that as your muscle gets older, it becomes more resistant to absorbing the protein, and you need a bigger bang for your buck, basically, in terms of protein synthesis to maintain a positive balance of protein in the muscle. So you need a higher intake of protein.
Welcome to Peak 40, the podcast gives you the tips, tactics, and stories for living your best life in midlife. If you're in your mid-30s to 50s, Peak 40 is the place to get actionable advice on the nuances of nutrition, training, recovery, and mindset in midlife. For the full experience and other valuable resources, register for the Peak 40 weekly newsletter at drbubs.com/peak40 to enhance your lifestyle and start making midlife your best life. Welcome back, or welcome to the Peak 40 podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Bubbs. This is Season 3, Episode 5, and today I'll be talking about muscle and bone loss and the consequences on health and lifestyle as you age. Dr. Ben Kirk, a research fellow at the Australian Institute for Musculoskeletal Science, where he is part of the Geroscience and Osteosarcopenia Research Group, will join us on the show. Ben's research focuses on identifying the risk factors, pathophysiology, diagnosis, and treatments for sarcopenia, the loss of muscle mass and function as you age, and osteosarcopenia, loss of bone density and muscle mass and function. Ben will share the latest evidence-based nutrition strategies from protein to creatine, vitamin D, and more, to the importance of maintaining strength as you age. All right, let's get started. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Hi, Mark. No problem. It's a pleasure to be invited on. As I said to you before, I've heard good things, and looking forward to sharing some knowledge bombs, hopefully.
Fantastic. Well, knowledge bombs are very well accepted here, so this is tremendous. And I think a great place to start would be just to tell listeners a little bit more, you know, about your background and your journey into your current role.
Yeah, well, currently I'm employed as a clinical researcher at the Australian Institute for Musculoskeletal Science, and that's affiliated with the medical department at the University of Melbourne. So, yeah, it's a lot of words there, but basically what I do on a day-to-day basis is I try test and both validate diagnostic and therapeutic approaches to muscle and bone loss with aging. So a term now what we call osteosarcopenia. So that could be from running longitudinal trials, so looking at data over time in people and how muscle and bone loss occurs, to then looking at therapeutic clinical trials, and then looking at risk factors, actually, that we're a university hospital. So we look at patients that come to the hospital as well and what's causing them to have falls and fractures, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, this is an area where, you know, I deal a lot in men's health and a lot of men as well, the 50, 60, 70 plus in this area of osteosarcopenia, obviously affecting, you know, women as well. But it's an area that's, you know, if you have family members or colleagues that have been affected by a fall and how that can change the quality of life in all areas of life for individuals. So, you know, maybe before we dive into that end, maybe we can just zoom back out and become a bit more familiar with this term osteosarcopenia, because I'm sure a lot of coaches listening in and practitioners familiar with osteoporosis, sarcopenia. Can you tie that connection in a little bit more clearly for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of the listeners will be familiar with, as you mentioned, the term osteopenia or osteoporosis. So that was defined over back in, when was it, 1980, as the age-related loss of bone causes fragility to bone and predisposes to fractures. But then more recently, in 2015, sarcopenia has come to light. So it was actually first coined back in 1990 by a gentleman, Dr. Erwin Rosenberg, and sarcopenia is the Greek words for flesh loss. But then that's come to light that sarcopenia actually is a clinical condition that also causes falls and fractures. So sarcopenia is to muscle what osteoporosis is to bone. So it's the weakening, the loss of muscle mass, and then the weakening of that contractile protein that predisposes to falls and fractures. Now, we have a group of patients that, a subset of patients that actually have both of the conditions, and it's been termed recently as osteosarcopenia. And this is both the impact on an individual's mobility and quality of life, and the impact on healthcare expenditure is ginormous with this condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, with the aging population, I mean, we're seeing, you know, about a doubling over the next 20 or 30 years, 2 billion people by the year 2050 estimations. Obviously, as you mentioned, greater number of falls, fractures, hospitalizations, even just increased risk factors for other conditions. You know, if we look at root causes here, you know, some of the pathophysiology of osteosarcopenia between genetics, between just having that physical load, protein turnover, hormonal factors, can you touch on a few of those and explain how they would potentially be implicated with osteosarcopenia?
Yeah, definitely. So when we look at risk factors, well, we know that advancing age and getting older is a risk factor for every disease under the sun. And that's because
we can slow aging, but we can't reverse it yet, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Every organ deteriorates to some degree, if it be your heart, your muscle, your bone, lung capacity, etc. So obviously advancing age is a risk factor for this condition. And then more environmental factors would be physical inactivity or reduction in physical activity, and then poor nutritional status or malnutrition. And when we talk about those nutrients, we think of what you need for your muscles in terms of protein, and then we think in terms of what you need for your bone, which is both calcium and vitamin D. And a reduction in those nutrients over time will predispose to both sarcopenia and osteoporosis because the role of these nutrients play. But the overarching one here is physical inactivity. And if you looked on a graph, what happens to your muscle and bone mass over time, that would show a linear decrease. And so when we talk in terms of, let's focus on bone here for a second, we know you have two types of bone. We have the trabecular, the one inside, the spongy type, and then you have the cortical bone on the outside. And these both decrease across the lifespan. And you can lose by age 80 up to 50% of your overall bone mineral density. And obviously, that predisposes then to a fall and a fracture. Now, at the same time, your muscle mass and strength goes down as well after about the third decade of life. That's around 1% per year for muscle mass. And then they're about somewhere between 2-3% per year of muscle strength loss. So it's a bit more accelerated. So if you had a graph, like I mentioned, and you looked at muscle mass, muscle strength, and the amount of bone an individual has, that line would just be slowly going down across the lifespan. But when we hit around the fourth or fifth decade of life, so let's say a middle-aged adult, that's when it begins to creep up a little bit. And that is just because the obvious one is people become more inactive in their day-to-day life during that period. And then again, that'll hit at a higher threshold. So that line will go down again linearly when we around age 60 up to age 80. And again, that is because we are more inactive. There's poor nutritional status. And then individuals become institutionalized. So either they might have a period hospitalization where they could be bed bound, and they could be even during that period, you could be losing a lot more muscle and to a degree some bone as well. So then again, it predisposes you to osteosarcopenia, or you could be in a care home somewhere, a care home facility where there's low activity levels. We know that in those care homes, and the nutrition isn't the best either. So you're lacking those nutrients, which we talk about. So really, the main ones are aging, are physical inactivity, and poor nutrition. And then you have other factors as well, which we know now. And one of them is fat infiltration of both bone inside the bone marrow and inside the muscle fibers and around the muscle fibers. So in the opposite direction to what happens with your muscle mass, your strength, and your bone as it goes down across the lifespan, we've actually shown now different groups around the world that fat infiltration actually goes up across the lifespan. And that fat inside the tissue can actually break down the healthy muscle cells and the bone cells at doing their job properly. So turning over every day and holding on to the contractile protein, or be it the bone density of that tissue. And that's actually independent as well of obesity levels. So if you have abdominal obesity, let's say, fat infiltration of muscle and bone is actually a risk factor for falls and for a fracture or a fall independent of your overall obesity. So it seems to be this very specific type of fat infiltration that's definitely creeping into different organs, and in osteosarcopenia, that is apparent also. Now,
and Ben, if I jump in quickly, is that something that one might see with certain conditions, or are there other factors there associated with that infiltration or comorbidities?
Well, again, yes, there could be some comorbidities that accelerate that. So, but again, that could be, so sarcopenia is prevalent in individuals that have different comorbidities, diabetes, cancer, and so on. But actually, that is a natural process as well that we found in the natural population. It goes up, but again, it's accelerated in different circumstances. And that's all we know really about that fat infiltration at the moment. I mentioned as well other secondary causes of osteosarcopenia. Like I mentioned, it could be comorbidities or other diseases. It could be things like corticosteroid use is definitely a risk factor. So the medication corticosteroids for both bone loss and muscle loss. And that is because it's shown to increase myostatin in both tissues. And then myostatin can lead to protein degradation, breakdown mm-hmm. in muscle over time, and a reduction in bone forming cells. So the osteoblasts doing their job on bone, that's to keep it turning over and maintain the bone density. And then you'll have other the hormone decreases as well. So the different sex hormones, testosterone in men, hypogonadism, so low testosterone levels is a risk factor for the loss of muscle mass and bone as well, both tissues simultaneously. And then obviously in females, you have a decline in estrogen levels.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, in midlife, you think of maybe in the 40s, if people have a young family, work is busy, all of a sudden the exercise component starts to be, you know, there's a lack of time. And so exercise tends to get sacrificed. The nutrition becomes more challenging as well with this lack of time. And all of a sudden when people get into their, you know, into their 50s, you know, these become habits. And we don't, the nutrition isn't on point. There's a lack of activity. As you mentioned, there's going to be changes in hormones, whether it's perimenopausal, menopausal women with estrogen declines, whether it's men who simply, you know, lack of sleep, busy, stressful lives, you know, we can start to see that testosterone lowering as well. We're sort of setting ourselves up for an increased risk of some of these factors. And if we, you know, dovetail now and talk about some of those nutritional interventions that we could start to lay in with clients, particularly, you know, years in advance when some of these red flags start to show up, especially if you work in, you know, as a trainer or a strength coach or in rehab and GP and starting to see some of these things, you know, you outline some of the nutritional aspects, things like protein intake, calcium, vitamin D, you know, even creatine. Can you speak a little bit to those different elements and what some targets might be for practitioners or clinicians?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the most important nutrient out of them is probably your protein intake, and it's probably the most well-established. Now, older adults at the moment, with those with decline in muscle health, let's say those populations in care homes, institutionalized, living by themselves in communities, been shown across different populations worldwide that they're consuming around 0.6 grams by their body weight per day, to around 0.8 grams per day. Now, the government recommendations pretty much universally all over the world are somewhere around 0.75 to 0.8 gram per kilogram of body weight for protein. But there's various groups that have shown now, again, for the last, since the early 2000s, one group particularly, Stuart Phillips, which should be mentioned, which has done pioneering work in this area, but they've shown that as your muscle gets older, it becomes more resistant to absorbing the protein, and you need a bigger bang for your buck, basically, in terms of protein synthesis to maintain a positive balance of protein in the muscle. So you need a higher intake of protein. And they've shown, we have shown as well, that throughout both epidemiological studies, so looking at people over time, 10, 20 years, 30 years, that take a higher intake of protein, after you adjust for other factors, those with a higher intake of protein seem to preserve more lean body mass or muscle mass. And then in clinical trials, the benefits of protein at starving off the loss of muscle are quite strong. So there's no dispute really that an intake of protein now of about 1.2 grams to 1.5, so really up to could be double the recommended amount by the government. An older adult needs that just to maintain, preserve, or regain, let's say, what they've lost in earlier life. So protein intake is massive.
Yeah, it's incredible. I had Theo Spoglu on maybe a year and a half ago and talking, just as you mentioned, around the protein targets for older individuals and the, you know, the different potential strategies, even around gels or different protein delivery mechanisms to be able to provide some of the boluses in a more sort of convenient and, you know, easy to consume manner for, you know, particularly older individuals who are in care homes and whatnot, to be able to get that in, because obviously appetite and things like that start to impact that. But it is amazing when you think that, yeah, the typical client might be consuming less than the RDA and we're going to need 1.5 to 2 times that to really support this, right?
Absolutely. And when we talk about protein intake, probably the three T's, I like to call them, or I always refer to them in talks during my PhD, is the total amount that an older adult needs. And that's, like I mentioned, nearly double the RDA. So it could be from 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram per day of body weight. And that's what most expert consensus groups around the world, both in the medical world and the physiology world, that they recommend. And then, well, when we look at the type of protein, we know that, again, you get a bigger bang for your buck when it comes from animal sources of protein. Things like dairy products, chicken, meat, lean meats, you get the highest bang for your buck in terms of muscle protein synthesis. And then I think I'm a food first approach kind of guy, but I think supplement industry definitely can target for older adults because they have issues with malabsorption, they have poor dental health, some of them their appetites are low, especially when you consider these diagnosed patients that are almost frail and have difficulties walking. We're not talking about a healthy older adult here. And that is where the type of protein can come in. So things like whey protein is very fast absorbing. And again, it maximally stimulates muscle protein synthesis. And one of the key amino acids that you need amongst the whey protein is leucine as well. So your body, there's 20 amino acids out there, 9 essential amino acids your body needs from exogenous sources. So in terms of food, and then indigenously your body produces the other 11 out of 20. But one of those key ones out of the 9 essential amino acids is leucine. And that's very high in dairy products. So we need to find something that is both palatable for an older adult, something they like, and is convenient as well for these ones that I've mentioned that find it hard to get in to eat foods and to get in this nutrients. And again, touching on dairy products, I may be a bit biased here, but an older adult also needs higher intake of vitamin D, both for muscle and bone, and calcium as well. So we recommend around 800 to 1,000 IU per day. And that is to stay above your vitamin D levels of your blood work of 50 nanomoles per liter. That's below there is a deficient level, and that's when you have some problems. So 800 to 1,000 IU of vitamin D, along with calcium as well. The International Osteoporosis Federation recommends around 1,000 to 1,300 milligrams per day of calcium. And when you think of a dairy product, like a glass of milk, you get a bang in there with protein, whey protein, a little bit of calcium or casein, you get a good proportion of whey to casein, you get vitamin D and calcium in that one beverage. So there's a very nutritious package there, dairy products. And I think that might be fortifying dairy products might be a good way forward for those older adults, like I mentioned, which have poor issues taking in foods.
Hey friends, if you want to keep up to date on all the science related to midlife nutrition, training, and lifestyle, sign up for our Peak 40 newsletter for monthly updates on tips, tactics, and strategies to implement and level up your routine. Also, a big thank you to all those leaving us reviews for the Peak 40 book. Really appreciate the time, effort, and feedback. All right, let's get back to the conversation.
And the convenience factor alone of just being able to pour a glass of milk and, you know, in working with older clients, you know, trying to get them to start to go from a cup to a pint, you know, and then, you know, adjusting their cereal or toast intake to suit that, because oftentimes it tends to be more the tea and toast diet as individuals get older, and especially 70 plus, and trying to get them back to to more of those convenient foods, as you mentioned, things like a glass or a pint of milk. Now, what about things like creatine? Where does that layer in terms of, obviously, if we're better able to hit our 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilo, then we're going to be consuming more creatine. But is there a role there for supplementation? Is it simply from increasing food sources?
Yeah, again, meat products are high in creatine. Well, actually, go back, the physiological basis of creatine, obviously, is the Krebs cycle. It facilitates the replenishment of phosphocreatine and allows an older adult, if they're performing some kind of loading exercise, strength exercise, to replenish quicker. And then their work output is better. And then, therefore, they can gain more strength and more mass. But also, creatine has been looked at bone, and it's shown some positive, again, it's early, but it's shown some positive benefits on bone mineral density. So we think creatine definitely with resistance training, that's why we recommend it, because we know it's substantially proven to show benefits on muscle, so the sarcoid muscle loss. And in the bone industry, if you want to call it, it's starting to show some promise as well. So yeah, getting in, we recommend 3 to 5 grams of creatine per day. Now, to get that in, it could be done through supplementation, food products. But again, I think supplementation would be the way to go. So if you did have some cocktail there, like you mentioned, nutritious cocktail, where you get a good bash of protein, vitamin D, calcium, and creatine, it would be fantastic. And if that beverage also was user-friendly in terms of taste, because it's the most important thing for an adult, then that would be fantastic, you know. And while nutrition definitely complements the resistance side of things, the physical activity, there's no doubt that to prevent or treat osteosarcopenia, physical activity is king and nutrition is queen in that arena. But it definitely does complement it.
Yeah, it is incredible if you look around at hunter-gatherer populations or some of the quote-unquote blue zones around the world, or places where we have the most centenarians, and movement and physical activity is just baked into the cake of how they're daily living. And you see 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds and how they move in some of these areas, and it's in stark contrast to what you'd see in most of the quote-unquote developed countries, whether you're in the UK, Canada, US, a lot of places in Europe. And so that movement piece is massive. And obviously you've done a lot of work with your previous work and your PhD with muscle weakness, which is, again, as you've touched on, a big part of the issue here, because if we're getting weaker as we get older, we're more likely to have falls. As we've talked about previously, the cost in terms of the healthcare system is in the billions. It's just incredible. And, as you mentioned, once you get past the age of, well, even 40, but especially 50 onwards, that rate of muscle loss starts to increase. Can you talk a little bit about this connection between, muscle weakness, longevity, and quality of life, and some of the things that you uncovered in your work?
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned, when I did my PhD, it was surrounding musculoskeletal science, exercise physiology, and nutrition all in one in a clinical trial, really. But it was focused on muscle and sarcopenia. And I moved into the bone field as well. So I'm working with Professor Gustavo Duke, who's both a biomedical scientist and he's actually a clinician as well. So he's very much from bench to bedside, but he now has introduced me to this concept of a bone as well. So he's teaching me. That's basically why I moved halfway across the world, to learn more about osteosarcopenia. But yeah, going back to my PhD was focused just on muscle loss, on muscle weakness and sarcopenia. So we ran a clinical trial, and what we did was we wanted to see, really, it was the biggest one done in the UK so far. And there was a lack of trials done where we took a group of older adults who were physically inactive at the time. They were predisposed to muscle weakness, muscle loss. They were on a downward trajectory and at risk of falls and fractures. And we wanted to see what happens when you provide them, resistance exercise alone, or you give another group resistance exercise plus a higher intake of protein. And then what happens as well for those individuals who, let's say, for some reason they can't engage in physical activity, we wanted to see, can protein alone preserve muscle loss and muscle weakness across a certain time period? So we also had a protein group alone, and then we had a control group, which unfortunately for them, once they're randomized to that group, they don't get any intervention. So just to reiterate there, we had a control group who did nothing. We took a group that did physical activity, resistance exercise. Then we took a group that did physical activity plus a higher intake of protein, and then a group that took protein alone. And we did a battery of measures at baseline, and that was in terms of muscle mass measures. It was in terms of upper and lower body muscle strength measures. Then we looked at their electrical activity of the muscle as well, of different muscles, their upper limb and lower limb. And that was through electromyography, so EMG. You look at how well they can fire those muscles before and after these treatments. And we also looked at some cardiovascular outcomes as well. We looked at blood markers, cholesterol levels, hormones, lots of different things. Now, the end result of that trial showed that we showed that an improvement in both muscle health in terms of the amount of mass, the strength, the electrical capacity of the muscle all increased in these individuals that were previously inactive. And after the intervention, they substantially improved their muscle health and then were at a reduction of falls and fractures. And we didn't show in that trial that the added protein alone group, their muscle mass and their strength didn't change, whereas the control group actually went down. So there's some suggestive there that, so some suggestions that the protein intake alone was able to preserve over a period of 4 months, preserve their muscle mass and the strength of that tissue. It just didn't change in comparison to the control group. They lost leg strength. And remember, this is a very well-controlled, randomized clinical trial. So there's quite good evidence there now and from other studies that, as I mentioned from the start, if you perform resistance exercise and you take in more protein, you're going to get a bigger bang for your buck in terms of muscle mass and strength in comparison to resistance exercise alone. And then maybe perhaps if you, for some reason, you're bedbound or you have another clinical condition and you can't do exercise, a higher intake of protein definitely for muscle metabolism is going to protect what you have there in terms of the contractile proteins, which you need every day just to, for mobility, to move around, get out of a chair, climb up the stairs for an older adult, make sure that they don't slip over a curb or something and get a fracture, you know?
Yeah, that's obviously even seemingly more timely as well under the current situation with COVID-19 and people being homebound and not moving as much and not going to the gym as much or getting their resistance exercise in, and perhaps likely their nutrition changing as well with, if they weren't getting enough protein in to start with, if their meal frequency has come down or they're not consuming enough, you know, this is sort of adding on to the problem a little bit. And Ben, when we look at, you know, the evolution of research in this area, you know, where is your research going? Where is the field going in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I can briefly tell you, just maybe touching on where I'm going from this going forward, the studies that I have lined up. So we have just got access to an American database called Mr. Oz. So it's a longitudinal trial in older men between the ages of 70 to 80, and we track their muscle and bone every 3 months for over that time period. And it also looks at the amount of hospitalization, falls and fractures over that time period. And we're very interested in, when we look at bone loss and muscle loss, so osteoporosis and sarcopenia, and that leads to osteosarcopenia, which one occurs first? Does somebody lose bone and then they lose muscle and then they develop osteosarcopenia? Or is it they lose muscle mass first and then bone and then they lead to osteosarcopenia? Now, when we look at the percentage of muscle loss and bone loss across the lifespan, it would suggest that bone loss occurs at a slower rate. So that would suggest that sarcopenia actually develops first before osteoporosis and then leads on to osteosarcopenia. And that hypothesis as well comes from, if you take an individual and throw them into a bed for 10 days and make sure that they don't move at all, we know that they'll lose more muscle mass over that time period than they will bone. But what we're trying to do, obviously, is establish the evidence of this in an older adult cohort. So I'm going to be looking at a life course approach, basically, from the ages of 70 up to maybe 90. And we're going to look at the transition rates of people losing muscle and bone and leading to osteosarcopenia. And then we're going to look at, well, how many falls and fractures they've had and hospitalizations throughout that year. And we're also going to be looking at what biomarkers, so in terms of hormones, are linked to muscle and bone loss and linked to osteosarcopenia at this stage. So that's one of the epidemiological studies that I'm working on with the National Institute of Health on Aging, with a collaborator, Peggy.
Well, listen, if you have any questions,
a university in San Francisco medical department. And then I'm going to be running two different clinical trials, one of them looking at a pharmacological marker to see if it can, or pharmacological compound to see if it can improve muscle and bone mass in osteosarcopenic patients and reduce falls and fractures. And I'm also going to be looking at a nutritional cocktail, if you want to call it, or a supplement which has benefits, we hope, for benefits for both muscle and bone. And this is in randomized double-blind clinical trials in patients that are diagnosed with osteosarcopenia. And then we look at the very important outcomes as well in terms of falls and fractures. So that's what health policy want to know. They don't particularly want to know if you put an individual on this intervention, did they increase their muscle mass or strengthen their bone mass? But they want to know the key, the hard outcomes in terms of hospitalizations, falls, fractures, cost benefit. Does this compound, pharmaceutical or nutritional compound, does it work on ultimately reducing falls, fractures, mortality rates in these individuals? And that's then going forward, we can try translate that into health policy. I can't really mention what those drug compounds.
Like, can we test your arm here?
Nutritional beverage, but it's probably along the lines of what my recommendations are or what I've talked about on so far. So there, basically, that's one from an epidemiological study, and then there's one from a double-blind clinical trial that I'm going to be going ahead with in the next few months. And other things that we need to look at as well is, can we get a blood biomarker for osteosarcopenia with high diagnostic value? And that would be really effective. It would be incredible, yeah. So if we can get one of these markers, so maybe it is a cell type that shows up in your blood and is indicative of declining muscle and bone health. So it's a quick and reliable, and it's high diagnostic value, like I said, for a clinician. So then we can quickly put those individuals onto a rehabilitation program instead of going through this long process at the moment, which is measure their bone mineral density, measure their lean body mass by a DEXA scanner, take their grip strength, take their gait speed, and then try to implement all of this stuff, which is a bit more cumbersome at the moment for clinicians when they consider, you know, that they're under-resourced and overburdened in a lot of places anyway. So it's very hard to push this into clinical practice at the moment. And then the final thing that I think needs to be done is probably after all this work is look at the synergistic effects of exercise training, of nutritional intervention and drug compounds at the same time. Can we get a triple bang for your buck there in terms of cost to benefit and of all these interventions on reducing your risk of osteosarcopenic outcomes, falls and fractures, mortality, hospitalizations? And ultimately, what you want to do is improve an older adult's quality of life, their mobility, so then they can move around, socialize more. And we know if you socialize more, you're less chances of getting things like dementia and loneliness and so on, which is loneliness is the biggest killer of them all for an older adult. So that's the space we're working in at the moment, or at least I foresee in the next few years while I'm here at the Australian Institute of Musculoskeletal Science.
That's fascinating stuff, Ben. I mean, it's such an incredible field, and obviously with an aging population so important and potential for some massive changes in the healthcare system and the benefits for patients and, you know, for myself and anyone listening in who's got older parents, it's obviously very topical as well, or treating clients, because you can really make a big difference with some of these interventions already. And of course, with what's coming down the pipeline, hopefully we'll be able to influence them even more. So really appreciate you carving out some time today. If people want to keep up with your work, and we'll obviously link to your papers in the show notes, but people want to keep up with your work, where's the best place to stay in touch with you?
Yeah, so I'm pretty vocal on Twitter, so at Dr. Ben Kirk, but I'm sure I'll put up you'll put up the links for me on this. But at Dr. Ben Kirk, if you want to look at my publications or some of my research that I've done, it can be accessed through ResearchGate. If you type my name into Google Scholar, you will see some publications that I've mentioned around this area. More recently on osteosarcopenia, previous publications were on sarcopenia from my PhD, But now we've got lots of medical reviews where people can, even non-scientific base, can read, and it's quite easy information to digest. And we've got a lot, I tried to put in lots of figures. So, you know, it breaks down the risk factors, the pathophysiology, and the treatments which we recommend for this condition, which ultimately is very important now because we're trying to push it into clinical practice and get it seen by clinicians and other people, other health professionals. But yeah, ResearchGate, Google Scholar, or on Twitter. And also there's a University of Melbourne expert page, which you type my name into Google as well. It'll come up with my background, my bio, and a list of publications and what I do. And if there is anybody out there that's wanting more information, I'm happy to, in time, obviously, but take some questions via email as well, which you'll be able to find easy enough on any of those websites.
Amazing, Ben. Listen, thanks again for taking the time. And yeah, look forward to keeping track of all your work coming up.
No problem, Mark. And thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to Peak 40 Podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. And also, please share with friends, colleagues, and anyone looking for Peak 40 health and performance.
The Dr. Bubbs Performance Podcast endeavors to provide accurate and helpful information to listeners. These podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Dr. Bubbs Performance Podcasts.